What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? These are Conversations from the Pointed Firs.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly hour-long interview with authors, artists, makers, and doers who live amongst us and contribute to the collective history and culture of this great place where we live.
I'm your host, Peter Neal.
My guest today is Ian Luders, rambler, islander, tinker, freethinker, folklorist, maker, historian, and editor of the privately published Didn't Do Much But a Little of Everything, the 1897 Eagle Island Diary of Dalton Rains, as splendid and surprising an evocation of the spirit of Maine as I have encountered in some 35 Pointed Firs interview to date. Ian, welcome.
Thank you.
Your book has been such a surprise. I was given a little hint as if I was being initiated into some kind of secret society of readers who knew of this secret text about a secret place with secret people, secret behaviors, all of which were to be kept secret, except that you got them together, found the diary, and wrote it all down. Before we start, though, I want to talk about one thing that you do in this book, which I find almost unique. You open the book with a land invocation. Would you talk about that a little bit?
So you hadn't seen that before? It seems like sort of a trend lately that people are trying to bring some consciousness to the fact that our culture is kind of an invader culture, and making some sort of a reference to, you know, this is native land that we're on. And I wanted to do that, but in doing it, I chose to write about language, native language, and how the landscape around us is, we refer to it in English, but with some native place names mixed in still. But I love the way that native language and place naming traditions are tied in with storytelling that then adheres to the landscape. And that's something that I find in my experience of Eagle Island through my mentor there, Bob Quinn. I have access to this layer of language and lore that sits on the landscape.
Trend it is, public meetings, organizational meetings.
Right.
Don't do it consistently, for
right.
example. And sometimes I wonder just how performative it is.
Sometimes it is a little bit. Yeah.
A little bit. And I'd never seen it in a book before.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'd never seen it in a printed book where the book itself is an occupation
yeah.
of the space in which you were living and you were writing about
yeah.
it. And I thought it was brilliant. I really was impressed by it because I said, nobody's going to notice this. This book has not been seen by thousands of people.
Right.
Therefore, it's real.
yeah.
It's not performative.
Right.
This was done for the right reason.
Right.
And it was great.
Well, that's nice. I mean, it's true. And maybe that's one of the qualities of it being such a under-the-radar self-published book that I just kind of did things the way it seemed to make sense. But you're right. As you say, it's not something you see usually in the opening of a book.
Let's set the scene. Where is Eagle Island? Tell us how you found your way there and how you stumbled over or were introduced to this very special, odd journal, this diary of 1897. Can you give us the background of how it all worked out?
Yes. Eagle Island is about a mile long and a half mile wide, small island, pretty much directly between North Haven Island and Deer Isle in East Penobscot Bay. It was settled in the early 19th century by the Quinn family, and for most of the time since then has been predominantly the people that have lived there and made their lives there have been Quinns or have people that married into the Quinns and descendants. And I just happened into the place the way I happen into most things in my life, just sort of stumbling into something. Some friends of mine were doing a roofing job out there, and I went with them. And this was maybe 9 years ago or something, not quite 10 years ago, probably about 9 years ago. And I was just there for a long weekend doing this roofing job, but hit it off with Bob Quinn, the patriarch of the island, who's quite a storyteller. And I'm a story listener, and I really loved how he had sort of every object that we came across as we, you know, I went down to a certain barn with him to get some staging for the job, and he, everything we had to move out of the way to get to the staging had a story. And so I was really interested in him and the place as one complex, you know, the way that the place had such a dense web of story laid onto it, and he was the keeper of that.
But why you? I mean, it's you were a stranger. You were from very far away. why would he take you under his wing? Why would he trust you?
Well, he's a, you know, as a lore keeper, sort of like the old man in the, you know, the albatross poem, the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. He just he stops a wedding guest and just starts telling him this story about being on the wild seas and seeing all these visions. Bob is a little bit that way. He's a wonderful Homeric storyteller where he's just, this stuff is, these dimensions of island life are living in him all the time, and he wants to share them. So here was a newcomer, and he instinctively saw pretty quickly that I was somebody who liked this kind of storytelling, and we made a good match.
But you were not some visiting anthropologist with your notebooks.
No, that would have been different.
Come to steal his stories and,
right,
and take them away.
Yeah, no, I was a worker, and that was a key to it too. And then so that was then, and then maybe a year and a half went where I wasn't back on the island, but I was thinking about it often. Oh, I want to get back there. I want to spend more time with Bob Quinn. And then just more happenstance, I just ran into him and his wife in the parking lot of the Belfast Hospital, totally by accident. One thing led to another, and we, you know, I was about 2 weeks later, I was living on the island. Mm-hmm. And since then, so this is my seventh year right now, where I live 6 months of the year on Eagle with working with Bob and his family.
And the other 6 months, you're a bit of a rambler.
Yeah, but the other 6 months, mostly these last several years, have been in a cabin over on the Vermont-New Hampshire border, kind of a little monastic retreat, scholarly retreat, little cabin.
You seem not to be afraid to be alone.
No. No, I rather depend on some of that, mm-hmm, during the rhythms of the year.
How did that come to pass? What's the history that essentially formed this rambling man?
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. That's hard. I mean, I know the aloneness part of it is that since, you know, as a kid I was kind of a sidelined, you know, in the scrappy schools of Ware, New Hampshire, where I grew up. I was the picked on kind of bookworm, you know, off to the side kind of person. And so that it's one of these cases of it's the solitude is not experienced as solitude because I'm in the company of, you know, people in other dimensions and other worlds through literature.
You've talked about the cabin in New Hampshire. Living off the grid, I'm assuming that you have thousands of books in there for insulation purposes.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. One presumes you've read them all.
Yeah, a lot of them. The mice have started to eat them. That's a problem. They're my companions.
Smartest mice in the Northeast.
That's right.
That's right. So you come to Eagle. You come under the tutelage of Bob Quinn. Did he introduce you to the diary itself?
Well, no. That was an interesting thing. The diary, so after about a year of saturating in Bob's stories and working side by side with Bob, I was going stern with him. He was fishing still then. He doesn't have any traps out this year, but he's 86 years old. He's slowing down some, but we fished for a good solid 5 years together. And so that work and then all this other puttering work on the island, maintaining buildings and helping with, his daughter runs a rental business out there, helping with that. You know, working together in this landscape where not only has he worked all of his life, but his father and uncles and grandfather and grandmother and great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather. His great-great-grandfather, Samuel Quinn, settled the island around the time of Maine statehood, 1820. It's really true that every rock on the island he has a story about. And we'd be in the woods somewhere digging a hole and there'd be all these stories that he'd tell me. Or we're out on the water and the ledges underneath us would have stories. You know, you can't even see them. And that was a real rich nourishment for me. And after a year or so of that, I was so deep in it all. And then Bob pointed me to a book he and Helene had a copy on their shelf. And I'd actually met this guy who wrote this book once before. He was a part of this community down east that my cousin lives in. Paul Molyneux is his name.
Yeah.
Really good writer. And mm-hmm. this great book, The Dorryman's Reflection, really good book about the fisheries. That book, Paul fished with a guy named Bernard Raines out of Owl's Head in the 80s. And Bernard is a grandson of Dalton Raines, the author of this diary. So looking at that book, well, I read that book. Bob lent me the copy that Bernard had given to him because Bob's a distant cousin of these people because they're, you know, way back in the day, like Dalton's mother was a Quinn. So So Bob had this book and showed it to me and I read it. And in there's just a passing mention Paul makes of this diary. And I got in touch with Paul. Paul put me in touch with Bernard's widow, because Bernard has died since. And Eleanor Raines, who still lives in Owl's Head, was the one who gave me access to this diary.
So it is not a voluminous thing.
No,
just describe it physically.
Well, it looks like a checkbook or something. It's sort of a working man's day book that was very common, I think, in the turn of the century.
It's where you kept your accounts.
Yeah, you just keep little notes.
Lists, your to-do list.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And I was convinced that this was going to be a magic lantern that would open up all of the past of the island, you know, fill in all the gaps in the stories that Bob was telling me. And I was actually, to be frank, kind of disappointed once I started to read it because it was so terse. You know, the way that a diary just refers to things, because you're just writing for yourself. You're not really writing for anybody else. So you say things in an offhand way. You don't have to explain anything. So it was kind of obtuse. But then I kind of rose to the challenge and worked that winter teasing out, learning how to read in between the lines. That became the pleasure of the reading of the book.
Terse it is. The title of the book didn't do much, but a little of everything is one of the entries. That was day 27.
That's April 17th, I think it is. That's all he says. And I love that phrase, didn't do much, but a little of everything. And it's wonderful because it doesn't tell us anything about what he did. It doesn't help us as historians one bit. But it kind of does when you dig into it and you contextualize it within the rhythms of his year. You know, once you learn to read the entries that are around it, then you have a pretty good idea of what various jobs he puttered at that day. You know, he worked some on the sloop, he worked some on the weir, he worked some on making some traps, this and that. But there's something just structurally about that, that that's this puttering quality to the work, to most of the work that he does throughout the year in this book is really well encapsulated in that entry. Didn't do much, but a little of everything.
I don't think puttering is a fair word. Oh, it's no? So much better than puttering. Yeah. I mean, he's dealing with the mundane tasks of life.
Yeah.
So he did this, he did that. These were all part of what was demanded, expected of a routine that basically added up to survival in very difficult conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing could happen overnight. Nothing was fast. Nothing could be purchased and arrive fully born.
Yeah.
Everything had to be made for itself. So in fact, each little bit of not much added up to a lifetime of everything.
That's right.
And it's like an existential motto.
Yeah.
You know, it says, all right, you want to live your life successfully, don't do much, but make sure it's a little bit of everything.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're paying attention to every aspect of your life.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? That's not a bad lesson to learn.
It's not. I like that reading of it. That's really good. I mean, I guess I'm kind of dignifying the word puttering or reclaiming it from aimless, ineffectual work.
Right.
Because I find in my life on Eagle and the sort of echo layers of my and Bob's working life on Eagle with this 120-year-old working life on Eagle, that's one of the structural elements to the book, this echo between my understanding of Dalton's work through my work with Bob on the island. And certainly I find on Eagle Island, the days that I get the most done are what I would call puttering days, where I start one task and then I get distracted to another and then I return to that one and then I do another one. And by the end of the day, I've done a little of everything.
So you had the physical object.
I had scans of it.
Scans, okay.
That Paul Molyneux had made and that Eleanor had given me permission to use. Yeah.
And then you had these terse observations and you had a kind of intervening curator in Bob Quinn,
yes,
who was helping you maybe understand some of the real history or some of the technology that was being discovered and discussed.
Yeah.
In the book, actually, as you read it, though, Bob Quinn is not there. He's everywhere, right? But he doesn't actually appear as a figure.
That's right.
In the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in the afterword, having recognized that, I wrote this text about a year after the book had first started circulating and stuck it in as an afterword. I really lay into that acknowledgement of his role in it, because it's truth. Certain things geographically, of course, because it's the exact same world in which Bob had lived his whole working life. So when Dalton says offhand, the Nubble, Bob knows exactly what he means by that, whereas I didn't, because you look around on a chart, you don't see the Nubble, but it's right there. It's the Nubble on Butter Island, and there's no doubt in Bob's mind that that's what he means. There was certain very explicit things like that, where it was just Bob was almost like the translator of ones of these. But then, more importantly, you know, Dalton is fishing tub trawl. It's sail power. It's just on the verge, 1897. It's just before motors start making the bay into a noisy place. He's sailing a little friendship sloop, fishing tub trawl for groundfish. There's herring wares, early lobster traps. All of these technologies are not what Bob and I are using, but through the work that we're doing with, you know, metal and PVC mesh lobster traps and, you know, whatever we're doing, and a big, loud diesel fiberglass boat, through the lens of that labor and Bob's memory, Bob's layering in of his father's and uncle's and grandmother's stories, I was able to, you know, the experiential knowledge of Bob and my experiential knowledge working with Bob is what opened up my understanding of Dalton's entries. I think I say something in that afterward that without the working relationship to the island that I have through Bob, it would just be a dead letter. The diary wouldn't mean anything to me. I wouldn't have been able to breathe life into it.
The World and available as podcast and archived on WERU.org and pointedfurs.org. My guest today is Ian Ludders, student of life on Eagle Island, where over the past decade he has lived and worked and learned from the residents there and their special history as farmers, fishers, and keepers of the Eagle Island Light. Ian Ludders found a terse late 19th century journal by a resident of Eagle Island, a catalog of daily event and experience that have shaped our lives and special ways of living here in Maine. Dalton Raine's diary from 1897 is a unique primer and effective documentation of that life. This is Conversations from the Pointed Furs, a monthly hour-long interview with authors, artists, makers, and doers who live amongst us and contribute to the collective history and culture of this great place where we live. You use the word lore keeper.
Yeah, I do.
And, but the idea that there's this lore, which the word, when I hear it, in my mind, says real,
mm-hmm.
purported,
yep.
Useful, possibly not credible.
Yeah, all
of these things.
Yeah.
And so that you have human agents taking the lore and kind of bringing it through successive sensibilities down to an interpretation where, in fact, you enter it as the editor, historian, and you apply the modern academic trope of the footnote. Yeah. The footnote.
Yeah.
And so 2/3 of your book,
yeah.
of the book that you've edited, driven, motivated by these terse entries day by day, is completely filled out yeah. by these discursive footnotes
yeah.
in which your own personality is revealed.
Yes.
I mean, sometimes I laughed out loud. Sometimes
yeah.
I scratched my head and I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It's a whole nother dimension that editors don't normally bring to the conventional way of editing somebody's journal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the footnote, I think I'd actually says this explicitly somewhere in the introduction. The footnote, I came to realize that I loved Bob Quinn's storytelling style, which is a typical fisherman, Down East fisherman storytelling style, which is very digressive. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one of the old Bert and I routines really crystallizes that. The mailman comes by and he says, "Did you get any frost to your place this morning?" to the old guy. And the old guy talks for about half an hour. Well, like, well, this morning I got up out of bed and, you know, this and that. It takes him half an hour because he has to describe everything that he encounters on the way down. And as I looked out, you know, on the lawn, there was just a little bit of frost on the grass. But it takes him that half hour. There's all those wonderful Greek words for rhetorical devices. And apoplanesis is the word for when somebody asks you a question and you kind of evade it by digressing. And it's not necessarily an evasion in the classical Down East storytelling style, but in a way it is. It's almost like, in order to tell you that, I have to tell you 10 other things. You don't know that, and you might be too impatient to hear this, but I have to. Structurally, this is how you'll fully understand what I'm going to tell you. This digression is built into the storytelling. And so I've found, how do I put the oral literature, the experience of engaging Bob Quinn's oral literature, how do I get that into a book form? And the footnote ended up being it. And it's comical, it's meant to be comical, that some of the footnotes are 5 pages long and the entry that it's commenting on is, you know, one sentence long. To use a musical analogy, you know, counterpoint or harmonic texture, another voice coming in, a digression going off in a apparently tangential direction, but leading back in, you know, enriching the original point made. That's my experience of walking around the island with Bob. So I was trying to make something structural in the book that would imitate that.
Well, Ian, I just want you to know that your secret as a student of comparative literature and Greek is secret with me. No one will ever hear about the fact that you dropped Greek in this program.
That's good. Yeah, hopefully.
Nobody will know that.
You can edit that
out. No, absolutely not. It's reading between the lines, in a way. It's filling the silences and at the same time allowing the silences to resonate.
That's
evident. It's not just a trick.
Yeah.
It's something that becomes a participation. The audience will maybe not understand my enthusiasm about this because I read it the first time through as a modernist novel. As if it was a Vladimir Nabokov unknown, undiscovered manuscript that had been suddenly found somewhere in a bookstore in Stonington.
Yeah.
And it does have those levels of meaning that go back and forth and back and forth that make a simple thing complicated.
Yeah. Well, I like to do that. I like to complicate simple things. And then the Nabokov thing, I make explicit in the introduction, too, because, you know, I love Pale Fire, which is a novel that's made out of, you know, it's a primary text, a poem, and then annotated with all these endnotes by this really mentally unstable, weird guy, and it's a hilarious novel. But I don't know if you remember, in the same breath that I mentioned Pale Fire in that introduction, I also mentioned Nabokov's incredible work of scholarship that he did around the same time, and I always thought that they cross-pollinated probably the novel and his edition of Evgeny Onyegin, the Pushkin poem. He did, there's like a whole volume of footnotes to that poem that he made, and so that's a closer model. You know, you say a modernist novel, but the fact is the closer model is Nabokov's other footnote confection, you know, this Onyegin edition, because it's actually historiography, you know, modernist historiography might be closer to the point, because I make great pains to, even if it's really speculative, I'm trying to, you know, find some kind of a trace of historical plausibility, you know, in everything I'm doing in the book, just as Nabokov is. He's not making up this stuff about Pushkin and his affairs and stuff like that in those footnotes. So that's the better analogy. And I think of that with some of the stuff I learned fishing with Bob. You know, you learn these pieces of bottom, where to set traps, lobster fishing. You learn where these good pieces of bottom are. And then in order to be able to find them again, Bob still does the old-fashioned thing of taking marks. You know, line up this tree on this island with this rock on this other island, and then you can zero in on a spot on this surface of water, and you know that underneath you is this bottom. And I love that as an analogy because you never actually know the bottom. The fishermen never go there. We work there, we get these lobsters who are crawling around there, but we work there with ropes and other extended, you know, a sounding machine, things like that. We don't go there, and we never will. We don't actually know what it's like to be down there. We never will. And that's how it is for the historian. Historical reality is a very evasive thing. We sort of grope after it the way a fisherman gropes at the bottom.
One line that you do follow is genealogy, which is a didactic line of inquiry.
Yeah.
It's evident in the book.
Yeah.
There's a constant referral as a kind of positive timeline, which is the descendants of Quinns, even though we're talking about Rainses, but there is this sort of, it's like passing the baton of knowledge down through the generations.
Yeah.
And so what is a terse statement here can turn out to be a 1,000-word footnote here. Theoretically, we understand it better, but I'm not so sure.
Well, it's true. Sometimes some of those genealogical footnotes, even I, rereading them, kind of glaze over. I can't imagine the casual reader coming up like, what? You can't read this. But I actually like the fact that information is there now. It's encoded in black and white ink. It's right there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you can puzzle it out, and you could from the genealogical notes, I have a whole appendix of them. You could draw a huge, elaborate, probably the most complete genealogical tree that was ever drawn about of the Eagle Island
family
you mm-hmm. could do from it's mm-hmm. encoded in that appendix mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. that book. And I love that too as another symmetry with the terseness of the diary entries and then the fullness that comes from reading in between the lines. Genealogical facts are so bare and stark, birth and death, but you can, your job is to fill in the, read between the lines, fill in the blanks, imagine these lives, have empathy, you know, across the generations, have this interdimensional empathy and respond to these people.
Which somewhat explains this sort of popularization of genealogy in the 21st century.
It's true. Yeah.
As if you're trying, by going back through, you can find some kind of meaning in a senseless life or a life that doesn't seem to matter much. And nobody seems to care about things like family and community. But all of a sudden, you have this genealogy and you can go back into this island where people were living together every day, day after day, chore after chore after chore. And yet, they'd come home, they'd visit, they had worship, they had song. It does come across a little bit as a kind of simple, almost idealized community.
Pretty special place in 1897,
So one of the principal metaphors, structures in there, in the diary, there are two constructions. One is the building of the sloop.
Yes.
That he eventually launches and fishes from and all the rest. And then the other is the building of a weir, a fishing weir. Can you talk a little bit about the weir?
Yeah, well, I insist on pronouncing it weir. Well, I grew up saying weir too, but I learned that from Bob. And that's one of the points of this line between written and oral culture that feels important to me. And that's, speaking of the weirs, that's one of the reasons why there's such a it's such a powerful image for what the book is doing. I think one of the things about a weir is it's made largely from foraged materials. You make basically a fence in this elaborate shape in the intertidal zone or a little deeper. Driving stakes, it's just wood that you're harvesting in woodlots. Birch brush was used mostly, weaving that in like a basket. And this is all Native American traditional fishing technology. But then it's being used, you know, a herring weir is not a Native American tool. A herring weir is a hybrid. The invader culture, the white culture, has learned this native technology and now has adapted it to an industrial use. The herring fishery started in earnest in the 1880s when sardine canning began in the state of Maine, in Eastport. And that's when these weirs started being built. To get whole schools of herring, to put them aboard of a sardine carrier, to send them to a sardine factory. So there's this cool mixture in a weir between this scrappy subsistence living island fisherman foraging materials for free, you know, lots of work, building this elaborate structure. But then it's for this industrial use, it's for cash economy. It's not for his subsistence. The fisherman is doing a lot of subsistence activities, cashless economic activities that just support himself and his family. But the herring fishing is not. That's to make some cash, to get some extra, to get beyond the subsistence. And how that's done is through interacting with these sardine factories. And to make a modern fishing weir, a turn of the century herring weir, you'd need a bunch of twine too, a bunch of netting. So it's not purely foraged. You need some cash at the outset. And usually these fishermen didn't have the cash for that, so they'd use what's called company twine. And the sardine factory they're selling to would provide them with some twine in exchange for dibs on their cash. In the case of the weir in this book, one of the most beautiful things about the diary for me is that Dalton, the first months of the book, Dalton is actually in Augusta. He hasn't bloomed yet. He's only 19 years old, he's 18 as the book begins. And one of the beautiful things about the book is you're seeing him become a fisherman. You're seeing him take on his island heritage and become a fisherman. The book starts with him as a sort of a funny urban teenager in Augusta in the winter, kind of going to prayer meetings and socializing with his friends, playing checkers with the neighbors. But all the while, he's knitting a seine net, a large net that needs to be used to harvest the fish out of the pound of the herring weir that his uncle is building on the island this spring and that he's going to help him build. And he knits the seine at home in Augusta, in urban Augusta, and then brings that out to Eagle. That's a beautiful literary figure in Dalton's diary that I love. And so that twine, to me, represents, the weir can represent to me this hybridization of oral and written culture. You know, this old native technology of foraged materials, pre-industrial, is there, but also this industrial fishery is there, and this twine, the expensive twine. I mean, they shave off a lot of the expense by Dalton knitting that seine net himself, but they had to buy a huge amount of twine to knit that with, and then there's also further twine that's used in the pound that they bought or was provided. I speculate about in one of the footnotes that maybe it was provided by the factory they're selling to. Anyway, so the herring weir is this hybrid machine, kind of the way the book is.
But you get a sense of the weir as a highly evolved architecture, engineered to be successful in the forces of tide and wind
yes.
and wave and,
yeah.
and all this sort of thing. And when you realize how much labor went into making it, in the sense of there's no hammer, there's no nails, it's
yeah.
all sort of done by hand in a way,
yeah.
even the knitting of the twine.
Right, right.
It's sort of a wonderful metaphor
yeah.
for the efficiency and the practicality and the spirit of Maine.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the double entendre of the metaphor itself,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
And by the way, this is not kind of a pretentious literary thing when you read it. It comes to you. It's not as if you've designed this
right.
to happen to trick us.
Yeah.
it just happens because that's a little bit of everything that Dalton
yeah.
did each day.
That's right. I mean, again, to dignify the word puttering, just the making of the book for me was very much a puttering process. And this stuff just came to me. I didn't design it in, but it slowly dawned on me that these structural elements just organically were appearing in there. And the weir, I mean, also the receptivity of a weir, the passive receptivity, it's often discussed in modern talk about fisheries as sort of the one sustainable fishery that ever existed. A herring weir, you just build it in a cove where you think herring are likely to come in the evenings in the summer. And if they don't, you don't make any money. And Ruth Moore, the great novelist of the coast of Maine, who I nudge the reader about every third footnote, I kind of do a heavy nudge to read the novels of Ruth Moore. I love those books. And her first novel is called The Weir. Her father kept weir on Gott's Island off Mount Desert. And that's kind of where I first learned about herring weirs. And he doesn't make any money, you know, the whole season. And I think it finally fishes, the weir fishes like finally for him. And then he sells it to somebody else and goes off island. But this sort of passive receptivity, just unobtrusively setting yourself there in a cove, not going out and hunting the fish, not overfishing them, just if you come here, we'll take you. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's this passivity and this receptivity. And for me, one of the analogies of the weir is my receptivity to the oral literature of the island, Bob's transmission. And there's no way, like a book can't hold, one of the features of an oral literature such as Bob carries with him is excess. It can't be contained. And, you know, a herring weir can't capture all the herring in the bay. It's going to be a sustainable fishery because it'll just catch the ones that happen to go into these coves where there's weirs. And a book can't hold. This book by no means is a book of Bob Quinn's oral literature of Eagle Island. It's just a little herring weir that catches some of it and invites the reader into it. By nature, an oral literature lives in excess of any book. That's the relationship between oral and written culture.
But nonetheless, both of them have their mechanics, in a sense. One of them is the bindings. There's reference often where he's done a couple of bindings.
The bindings, that's
and
true.
And then he's done some weaving, the knot, the binding, and the knot. I mean, the fact is, the binding can't break, and then the knot can't come untied.
Yeah.
And these are so matter of fact, but they're so necessary and added on which so much depends. I mean, all the labor that's been invested in this thing, and you don't tie the knot right.
Right.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Another one that you talk about that comes out of the diary also is burying. Going for berries.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, it's just nice because, you were talking about survival and, these tough old fishermen, and that's what we tend to carry with us when we go to an old document from, 1897. Oh, it must have been a harsh life out there. But then, in this working man's diary, built 10 traps, hauled 50 bushels out of the wood landing where, and then the next day went burying. And it's like a lark. He and, he'll load the sloop up with a bunch of friends. On one occasion, it's Georgia Dunham, who actually he marries 3 years later. She and some other friends, it's her birthday, and they go down to Isle of Ho. They sail down to Isle of Ho to pick berries. And they spend all day, and they come. But that's the cool thing. It's pleasure. It's a lark, but it's also, those are valuable. They're not just buying vitamin supplements. There's an instinctive need that they need to diversify their nourishment, and berries are full of all this stuff. And that's why they're here, because for 10,000 years, they've been harvested every year to make human life more pleasurable and more healthy. And I like to think of it as a cultural practice, because when people are doing something for 10,000 years, which we know that all the berries in the Gulf of Maine have been being harvested seasonally in a joyful subsistence practice of harvest, when that's done for 10,000 years, that's not a thing of nature anymore. That's a cultural practice.
Mm-hmm.
And when, white people have been doing it for 300 years here on the same bushes, so they've inherited a cultural practice from the people who they displaced out of this land.
Mm-hmm. This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly hour-long interview with authors, artists, makers, and doers who live amongst us and contribute to the collective history and culture of this great place where we live. The program is produced by Leech Island Books and broadcast here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM and around the world, and available as podcast and archived on WERU.org and pointedfurs.org. My guest today is Ian Lutters, student of life on Eagle Island, where over the past decade he has lived and worked and learned from the residents there and their special history as farmers, fishers, and keepers of the Eagle Island Light. Ian Lutters found a terse late 19th century journal by a resident of Eagle Island, a catalog of daily event and experience that have shaped our lives and special ways of living here in Maine. Dalton Rain's diary from 1897 is a unique primer and effective documentation of that life. Dalton was a dabbler in religions.
Yes.
He was vulnerable. But he didn't settle in. Seemed to have been one. He seemed to have passed through every discipline, every religion he could find.
Yeah.
How about that?
Well, it's a neat feature of the diary, and I kind of take my contrapuntal voice in the footnotes about it. It tends to be rather arch and funny about it. Like, oh, here he is again, going to another prayer meeting. But it's a young man seeking meaning for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he start in the winter in Augusta. He's going to these evangelical Quaker meetings. He's going to the Salvation Army prayer meetings, and then once he's on Eagle, he's going to North Haven a lot, which is an important feature of Eagle. Really, culturally, it's an offshoot of North Haven. That's an important thing to understand about Eagle Island historically. The Quinns, actually, Bob's great grandfather who settled it, Samuel Quinn Sr., came from North Haven, and it still holds a lot of ties to North Haven. And so he's going over there a lot to the Baptist church, is what I think, what I've figured out he was going to. But then there's some Mormons there. He gets interested. He goes to some meetings of theirs. The funny thing about all of that is that I know with a historian's hindsight, I'm able to read all of that in this funny light, because as an adult, Dalton Rains was about as heathen as you can get. He was famously contemptuous of organized religion. I mean, there's one sort of little episode that comes down through the oral lore cycle Bob conveyed to me. Sometime he was living on Creehaven, like Matinicus wasn't even far out enough, so Creehaven right next door. And somebody asked him once, as a mature man, like, what have you got against the mainland? You know, you hardly ever go. And he says, too many churches. You know, so he had this reputation as an adult of an anti-church person. So it's interesting to see this teenager seeking, going through all these prayer meetings, but we know the end result as historians that he kind of rejects it all.
He grows up. He becomes from young adult to a grown man. He gets married. That in the book comes across as something of a surprise, as kind of a shock to the community.
Yeah.
What about that?
Well, he's married 3 years after the end of the diary to a woman who becomes really intriguing to me, Georgia Dunham. The scandal is that she actually had been his aunt by marriage. She had been married to his Uncle Edgar, who is a big character in the course of the diary. Uncle Edgar teaches him a lot about lobster fishing. He's sort of his mentor as Dalton is getting into lobster fishing. He's also a farmer. We think mostly on Eagle, we remember Edgar Quinn mostly as a farmer, but he was quite a fisherman too. Dalton will go haying with Uncle Edgar, help him haying. But he also learns a lot about fishing from him. Georgia Dunham was Edgar's wife, and they had two kids. But they've divorced by the time of the diary. And you see Dalton and Georgia spending quite a bit of time together late in the summer. And just, again, with the hindsight of a historian, you know that 3 years later they get married. And 3 years after that, so 6 years after the diary, they have a son, Phil Rains, who became quite a character in his own right in Camden, on the Camden waterfront. She's a really interesting character to me because of that scandal in the oral lore of the family. She's not talked about much, so it's hard to learn a lot about her. So she became a guiding spirit for me in the book. My research skills were really called into play there. I couldn't rely on the oral lore around her because of the scandal of the fact that Dalton married his ex-aunt by marriage. It wasn't really talked about. And Phil Rains had three daughters who were living in Camden. Two of them died in the last few years. I was able to meet one of them before she died. There is a third who's still living, and I've been in touch with her some. So to them, Georgia Dunham was their grandmother, but they didn't know anything about her. And so I had a lot of curiosity to the stuff that I've been able to dig up around, about her, because she was kind of buried in the family historical record, the oral historical record. So I actually found her grave recently. She doesn't even have a gravestone.
Yeah. It drove him from the island?
I think it did. That's my supposition. My guess is about a year of the end of the diary, George and his romance had developed probably, and they left, and I think they lived in Vinylhaven first, and then the marriage broke up, and he left Vinylhaven and went to Matinicus. And yeah,
and where is he buried?
He's buried in Camden, about 15 paces from where she's buried, by chance.
Amen.
When I found her grave, it was such a shock to me, because I'd visited that spot so many times, visiting his grave. He was born in Camden. It's funny, Camden, it's 13 miles or so from Eagle Island, which isn't very far, but all those miles are water. So we don't think of it in our car culture. You know, it's about a 75-mile drive around the bay from Camden to Sylvester Cove, Deer Isle, where the mailboat runs to Eagle. But back in the day, Camden was really a big link to the mainland for Eagle. And you see, in the course of the diary, you see people sailing back and forth all the time. So the Mountain View Cemetery in Camden is full of Eagle Island people.
You talk about the narrative as a magic window. And it's a great phrase to essentially aspire to if you're trying to create something that is fictional or non-fictional, it doesn't matter. If you can bring that kind of looking through the window, which sort of implies that you're going to be seeing something that's real, but the window now is magical,
yeah.
Right? Hopefully it doesn't turn into a mirror, but sometimes that happens too. But yeah, I mean, my point is that you don't have to win the Nobel Prize to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I really admire about this book, both the diary itself, which is kind of a reductionist poem. It's E. Cummings, if you took away the periods, and the capitals. And then it's magic realism at the same time, where you're looking through into this sort of world, a community that's filled with emotions and interactions and wisdom that adds up to an ending.
Yeah.
And the ending is always ambiguous. It's neither happy nor sad. It goes on, and the next generation takes up the tale. And I think that's one of the underlying successes in what you've produced here. You haven't failed as an editor or a translator or a curator.
That's good.
And so you haven't betrayed Dalton, I think, at all in the telling.
That was my hope, yeah.
So what happens next?
After the diary ends?
Not so much for Dalton. We know what happened to Dalton. He's in Camden. We know where he is.
Yeah.
I'm talking about you. Because Bob is with you. Bob is 86.
Yep.
You're still have a life to lead.
Yeah, and we're still working together. We're not fishing together, but we putter on the island. And he and I started a couple of years ago another project on the same model, because like you say, the diary is the magic window, and that's the written artifact. It's like an alchemy. I needed to, Bob's lore, the oral lore that Bob was the holder of, I needed to put it into alchemical relationship with this written object. And that's when I found the diary, that was the one, and it makes this kind of electricity. And I really like the results of that. So then a few years later, Bob pulled out this old fish oil stained herring scale spattered book that was his father's logbook during the herring fishery in the 1950s and early 60s. And Bob and I started a process of, I wanted to make a book similar structure to this, where there's a primary text and then a whole bunch of footnotes. In this case, really collaborative footnotes between Bob and me, his memories of this fishery, you know, some research by me, but mostly relying on Bob's oral memories of this fishery and annotating his father's logbook. So again, this alchemical relation between the written lore and the oral lore. That's the project we're working on now. And it's nice and it's interesting. You know, I thought when we stopped fishing, I thought, oh, good, we'll have more time and energy for that project. The opposite has been the case.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a reminder of how much, I mean, talking about alchemy, like I was saying earlier, how much the work with Bob, fishing with Bob on those waters, on those same ledges around which Dalton was setting lobster gear, here we are doing it, that's integral. The experiential knowledge gained from actually working in these waters and on the island is what made the magic window work. And so it's been a funny thing trying to focus on this literary work with Bob while we're not fishing together.
And it's not a direct translation. That's the other thing that I really love about this, that the footnotes were your own creative diary.
Yeah, that's right. That was a half-conscious decision to, again, bring in a contrapuntal voice, a harmony, another voice. So we'd have Eagle in 1897 through the diary, and then on some level in the footnotes and in the introductory texts, I work in Eagle Island now, Bob and I working there. And I think that's one of the reasons why the book works so well, is that you get these interdimensionality, these two layers of time. And the interdimensionality thing, I use that word a lot in the book because that's what it's like when you're participating in deep time like this, in lore cycle time, and living on this small island where it's possible to know the story of every single rock on the island. But working on the water is another form of interdimensionality. I use that analogy a few times. It was really confusing for me when Bob and I started going stern with Bob. Like, it's not a solid ground, you know, working on the water, the uneven, you know, we'd get back onto the island after fishing all morning, and I was like craving the solid ground and the, because I wasn't used to working this liquid element, this other dimension. It really felt like an interdimensional thing. And that's an analogy for how it is to participate in this deep time through Bob's lore cycle.
Well, you know, you talk about the fluidity of the experience on the ocean. On the other hand, you were of an age when you started this process where you were looking for grounding.
Uh-huh.
And you found it.
Yeah.
Unexpectedly.
I did find
but
a lot of
you ran aground.
Yeah. That's right. Looking back at this book, it's kind of a pile of fragments, you know, but they all work together. Or it's a seine net, you know, it's a herringware. And all these different little knots, they all work together and they form this whole. I've always loved in archaeology, they always say the most permanent thing in the human historical record are potsherds, shattered pots. Take a earthenware pot and smash it and then bury it. 10,000 years later, that's worth a lot more than any book or anything, because you can put it back together. You can learn so much about the human hands that formed it, the style. You can date things based on that. It's permanent because it's broken. That's a way of celebrating my inability to make a sustained cohesive structure out of whole cloth. I take this pile of fragments and make it.
The underlying pretension of this program is to try to isolate qualities that we can associate with the spirit of Maine. I'd like to hear your list. The book is filled with them.
Mm-hmm.
How would you begin to still out the nouns, put all together into a kind of composite, would define something as ephemeral as the spirit of Maine?
Well, one that jumps out right on the surface is seasonality or seasonal work.
Right.
Those are both really
yeah.
key things,
yeah.
that human adaptation to that.
Yeah.
That's a big one. And actually, kind of related to that is the tides. You know, these 12-foot tides we have, that intertidal zone, that continuous flux and the continuous cleansing and giving, the generosity of the tides, they give you these strange things that we have laws that allow us to claim as our property, you know, marine salvage law, and the ways that we can work with the water, tide mills, the Quaddy Power Project in Eastport back in the day that never came to anything, but the ways that tides are used, I mean, Bob and I will ground out his boat against the wharf and then let the tide lever, scraper down, painter, you know, and then the tide lifts it again, float a mooring rock, a 2-ton rock, with the tide, you know, use that constant flux to tremendous effect. In talking about that, emphasizing that as part of the spirit of Maine, I run the risk of focusing too much on coastal Maine, as out-of-staters tend to do. But that's another thing, the interaction between what Bob calls up in the state, you know, in the woods, you know, north of Bangor, and then the farmland further north of that. In the family story that comes through in Dalton's diary, there's a really funny interaction between up in the state and these islands. I mean, a lot of these families have their roots up in Etna and Carmel, and these places in north of Bangor.
It was all interconnected.
Yeah, it's important to remember
right.
the linkage.
Right.
I like that. And, yeah. and this book does that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is sort of this funny, dry humor that comes through a few times. Well, the title, like you said, that's the April 17th entry, and that's pretty funny, you know, dry humor. That's a main quality.
Let's stop there.
Okay.
let's leave them laughing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Great fun.
Yeah, there's actually a lot to talk about in that book, turns out.
Oh, yeah, we didn't touch on half of it,
yeah.
as far as I'm concerned. My guest today has been Ian Lutters, and in spirit, his mentor, Dalton Rains, both unique observers of history and folkways on Eagle Island in Penobscot Bay. Dalton Rains' diary from 1897 is a unique primer and effective documentation of that life, and is available by a special order from lulu.com. This has been Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm Peter Neal. Thanks for listening.